Hello, and welcome to another edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week, where we explore and analyze who and what have been making news at Iowa's state capitol, including the governor, lawmakers, and legislation that's in the works or could be in the works, and what it all means for all of us. I'm Dennis Hart, and I'm joined as always by Laura Bellin of the must-read political blog site Bleeding Heartland. Laura, good to be with you again after another busy, busy week at the capitol.
Yes, always enjoy talking with you, Dennis.
We have a lot to talk about with the legislature scheduled to end its session in a couple of weeks. But first, we need, I think, to start with this. Another person associated with the State House reported to have the coronavirus last week. That was the eighth reported case, as you know, in the House. Also last week, a second person associated with the State Senate confirmed to have the virus. And now, the Des Moines Register reporting that the state's Occupational Safety and Health Administration has told state legislative leaders that multiple workplace conditions at the state capitol may expose workers to coronavirus hazards. And OSHA is urging legislative leaders to facilitate immediate corrective actions where needed. So much to unravel with this one. Let's start, Laura.
Well, first, I want to start with the word immediate, because the OSHA inspection of the state capitol began on January 26th. And yet this letter was only just sent to the legislative leaders on April 13th, and it was just publicized today. And it seems like a long time. I mean, I really think they could have expedited their review of the safety conditions at the Capitol, because most of the legislative session is over. The big public events where people come and lobby the legislators, most of that has already concluded. Most of the committee meetings have concluded. And so we've now had a good 2 to 3 months of people being exposed to COVID hazards at the Capitol. What the OSHA letter said, they issued a separate letter that mentioned some violations that weren't related to COVID. But what they said in their hazard letter was that there was no violation of state law, but they did determine that the conditions at the Capitol put people at risk. For one thing, the social distancing was not always practiced and not enforced, that people weren't consistently having their temperature checked entering the building, and that employees weren't required to report positive test results, and that when positive cases were reported, there was no determination of whether the COVID-19 was something they had acquired at work. So those were the main points. It didn't mention the fact that they don't require masks at the Capitol, either for people who work there or for visitors. That may be because OSHA doesn't require masks in workplaces. But in any case, the legislative leaders, really, they could have done a lot more earlier in the session. And I wish that OSHA had made this determination earlier.
Let's talk about why very little has been done during this session to prevent, if you will, the spread of the virus. Largely, it has been the Republicans who have pushed against significant efforts to have mask wearing, to social distance. Democrats have asked for it.
Yes. I mean, the Democrats had an amendment when the rules were being considered that would have required face coverings. And the Republican leaders said before the session that they didn't feel that they could require people to wear masks. But of course, they have all kinds of dress code requirements for people who are on the floor of the Iowa House and Senate. And as we discussed a couple of months ago, the Ames state representative, Beth Wessel-Crichel, she tested that one day by wearing jeans in the Iowa House, and she was not called upon to speak because she was in violation of the code for wearing jeans. But they don't enforce any regulation on masks. I think one of the issues was just that a lot of the Republican legislators and staff aren't real believers in this pandemic being serious. And in the state Senate, they did at least allow the committee meetings to happen via Zoom. But even then, I mean, often the people testifying would be appearing by Zoom, but then the two Republican senators on the subcommittee would just be sitting side by side, not wearing masks. And in the House, they didn't allow any kind of remote participation in the committee. So if you wanted to speak at a committee or be present to participate, you had to be physically in the room. And so there were some Iowa House Democrats who said, don't put me on any subcommittees this year, because they didn't want to expose themselves to that kind of risk.
You make a good point when you say that Republicans may not believe in the seriousness of the virus. As you know, most national polls have shown that still to this moment, 50% of Republicans across the nation say they may not get vaccinated against the coronavirus, as opposed to 7 or 8 or 9% of Democrats. How in the world has this become a partisan issue, a pandemic becoming a partisan issue?
Yeah, and it's a little bit disappointing. I mean, there are in There's a number of Iowa Republican leaders who have been encouraging people to get vaccinated. So Governor Reynolds, she was vaccinated during one of her televised press conferences, along with her husband. All of the members of Congress representing Iowa have now been vaccinated, and they have been encouraging people to get vaccines. But in the legislature, the House and Senate Republican leaders have not, they haven't said whether they're Well, the House Speaker, Pat Grassley, has said actually that he chose not to get vaccinated. But the, most of the top Republicans haven't clarified whether they've been vaccinated. The ones who perhaps have been haven't announced that on their social media, whereas a lot of the Democratic legislators are posting their vaccination selfies or their pictures of their vaccination cards and saying, hey, you know, everybody, as soon as you're eligible, try to get a shot. But it's I sense on the Republican side that maybe perhaps they don't want to anger that portion of the Republican base that doesn't believe in the vaccine or doesn't believe that the pandemic is serious. So they're trying to walk a line by not really commenting on it. But meanwhile, we have 21 counties that turned down their allocation of vaccines from the state this week because they didn't feel that they had sufficient demand. So that's pretty concerning in terms of how we're going to get to herd immunity.
Yeah. And as you know, on Monday, anybody 16 years old or older across the United States was eligible to get the coronavirus vaccine. And you mentioned that numerous counties in Iowa turned back their vaccine, as numerous counties in California have done the exact same thing because of a lack of demand. And the New York Times had an interesting piece last week in which they really dig down deep into some statistics, and they showed that in those congressional districts where that went most heavily for President Trump in the general election, they are the ones that have the highest rate of vaccine hesitancy in the country. In other words, there's a correlation between those who voted for President Trump and those who are deciding, nope, not for me, I don't want to be vaccinated.
Well, just looking at the map in Iowa, the 21 counties where they turned down the vaccine, those were all counties where Trump got 60 to 70% of the vote. So it does tend to be in the more Republican-leaning areas as well here where there seems to be less demand. I should say Iowa opened up the vaccine to everybody a couple of weeks earlier. So as of April 5th, every adult in Iowa is eligible to get a vaccine. So the Pfizer is available to anyone age 16 and up, and the Moderna is available to anyone age 18 and up.
And because it's so widely available at this point, it seems fair to say if people are not getting vaccinated, it's not because they can't, it's because they won't.
Yes. I mean, there may still be some people who are housebound, people who have barriers because perhaps they work two or three jobs and they just haven't had a chance to schedule a vaccination. So I think there still probably is a group of people who are open to being vaccinated who just haven't managed to schedule an appointment. But I think it's fair to say that going forward, that the largest group of people who won't be vaccinated are the ones who are choosing not to be vaccinated, as opposed to the ones who can't get access to a vaccine.
Well, as I mentioned off the top of the broadcast, there have been 10 reported cases of the coronavirus in the State House and State Senate combined. You have written on your website, on your blog site, Bleeding Heartland, that, or at least asking the question on the blog site, is there a connection between virus outbreaks in the House and the Senate and the slowing down of floor action this session? Explain that.
Well, we're getting to the point, the last few weeks of the session, usually it's very busy. There are a lot of bills to be considered and business to wrap up. And yet last week, the Senate did about a day of work. Then they went home for the rest of the week. And the House debated some bills on Tuesday and Wednesday, but they didn't have any floor action on Thursday. And that's kind of unusual for this time of the year. I mean, we don't know when they announce that there are cases associated with the House and the Senate, they don't make clear whether these are state legislators or senators who are ill or staff or who's ill. And I asked the Democratic leaders of the House and Senate had a media availability last Thursday. And one of the questions I asked them was, how confident are you that contact tracing is occurring with these cases? And they're not very confident. I mean, in theory, they're supposed to be contact tracing in the House and Senate, but they don't they don't have a lot of confidence that this is occurring, and they don't get a lot of information. So they don't know, the people who are serving in the Senate or the House don't have any idea whether they've been exposed. They aren't being told if they've had close contact with the people who tested positive. And of course, as OSHA mentioned, it's not required that everyone who tests positive report that to leadership. So there may be undisclosed cases. And so the Democrats are feeling very uneasy. And one of the Democratic legislators who has been ill, she's missed most of the session, Amy Nielsen. She represents a Johnson County district, and she still hasn't been able to come back to work. She became ill in late January, and she's now one of these COVID long haulers. And she feels that she was exposed because there were too many people in the State House in January not wearing masks and not social distancing.
Do you think enough publicity has been given on this? In other words, we've talked about this periodically over the last weeks of this broadcast, so our listeners are well aware of what's not being done in the House and the Senate in terms of protection. Have the newspapers reported enough of this, do you think? It seems to be serious. Now OSHA's confirming there are some potentially serious problems. Has it gotten enough press, in other words, on television, radio, newspapers?
Well, I think in the newspapers, at least early in the year, I do think there was quite a bit of coverage of concerns about the COVID safety protocols and the fact that there were a lot of people in the building not wearing masks. And certainly I think there was coverage of the House committees not allowing remote participation. But the OSHA story, I mean, I think everybody picked that up. The Associated Press picked it up. Everybody is writing about that. That's a big story that probably will get a lot of attention. I feel that there's the Republican legislators, and I ran into this last week when I reported on one of the Republican members of the State House who had shared some anti-vaccine memes in his legislative newsletter, and people were very upset about that. They said, you know, hey, like, what, you know, why can't you take a joke, and what's wrong with you, and let, you know, lighten up. And I mean, we're talking about a pandemic that's killed almost 5,900 Iowans. I mean, it's a lot of people, and we're in a race against the variants right now to get people vaccinated. So, you know, I thought it was reasonable to question why somebody was making jokes about the COVID vaccines.
The person you're talking about is House Republican Ray Sorensen, representing Adair and Guthrie counties. Could you just describe a couple of the memes he seemingly made fun of the vaccines during the pandemic? What did he say?
Yes, well, he's been sharing at the end of his weekly newsletters, he's been sharing a lot of memes, and so they largely, you know, make fun of liberals and feminists and, you know, so democratic socialists. And a couple of them that he shared a week ago in his newsletter, one of them was a spoof on those TV ads that say, if you've been exposed, you may qualify for. So it said, 10 years from now, you're going to be watching TV and somebody's going to come on and say, if you received a COVID vaccine, you might be eligible for. So it was kind of leading people to believe that maybe people who get the vaccines are going to have long-term health problems. And then the other one was they juxtaposed pictures, and there was one that showed just like a normal-looking family from 2019, and it said, you know, normal people, and then it had somebody with a mask and a shield and holding a syringe, and it said, you know, crazy conspiracy theorists. That was in 2019, and then it was flipped around for 2021. The person in the mask and shield and holding the syringe was labeled the normal person, and then the people with their faces uncovered and just smiling with their family, they were labeled crazy conspiracy theorists. So it was implying that just, you know, these like very reasonable people who have questions about the vaccine, you know, that it was implying that somehow, you know, the mainstream is making them out to be these bad conspiracy theorists. And I did, you know, ask Representative Sorensen several times, you know, what were you getting at here? What was your goal in sharing these? And he didn't respond.
Well, maybe he'll listen to this and respond, although I tend to doubt that, but we'll see.
He also didn't clarify whether he's been vaccinated. That was one of the questions I had. You know, are you planning to be vaccinated, or have you been, or are you going to be encouraging your constituents? Because most of the Republican legislators have not been out there encouraging their constituents to get vaccinated. A few of them have said publicly that they have been vaccinated, but that's been the exception, not the rule.
Governor Reynolds stood tall last week, I think, when she held a news conference talking about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine pause in Iowa and across the nation because of concerns about a small number of cases of reactions to them, serious reactions. But she also said she had gotten the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, and she said she would do it again if she had the opportunity. And I thought that was a valuable statement on the part of the governor.
Yes, definitely. I mean, she's been out there, and the director of the Department of Public Health, Kelly Garcia, said the same thing. She was vaccinated with a Johnson & Johnson shot at the same press conference where Governor Reynolds was. And, you know, I mean, I think that's very reasonable. Everything that I'm reading says that the complications are limited to a small group, I mean, women between the ages of 30 and 50. So, I mean, I've been reading some of in the medical community, there's some real debate about whether they should have halted the Johnson & Johnson vaccines. Maybe they should have continued vaccinating men while they studied this data about women. But in any case, it seems to be a problem, a complication that they've only observed in women under 50. So it's very important to get people vaccinated as soon as possible. And I do think that Governor Reynolds has been out there frequently reminding people of that.
Well, here we are. We're halfway through the broadcast already at 15 and a half minutes after the hour. And we've been talking about the coronavirus in the state capitol because our mission here on this broadcast is to discuss things that go on that are of importance at the capitol. And there's hardly anything of more importance than this pandemic that's been going on. But the capitol did get some actual work done last week in terms of legislation. So one of the most important things that I really want to get to right now, the House passed this wide-ranging Back the Blue bill that came in response to last summer's protests in Des Moines across Iowa and probably across the United States. There was probably some of that involved in this bill. I'm going to ask you to give us the details on that, but I'm going to set it up by saying it is quite interesting that state lawmakers responded in this way, backing the blue, because apparently, as I've said on this broadcast before, the message they got from all the Black Lives Matter protests in Iowa and across the country was to protect the police. And that's what happened here.
Definitely. So before the legislative session, the governor proposed a bill which she described as a balanced bill that would have included a ban on racial profiling and also measures that were perceived to support the police. So increased penalties for protest-related offenses, expanding crimes associated with protesting. One of the amazing things, increasing benefits for police officers was a part of it, but one of the issues was increasing the penalties for eluding, failing to stop for a law enforcement vehicle. And the advocates, Black Lives Matter and others, the NAACP, I mean, they were very concerned that this bill, although the governor described it as a balance, that it wasn't really that balanced. It was mostly full of things that seemed to be targeting protesters of police misconduct rather than things that would support them. So in any case, the legislature then doubled down and tripled down on all of that. So they didn't advance the ban on racial profiling, but they did advance the measures to protect the police. And in fact, they increased them. The one thing that the governor wanted that's not in this bill that the House approved last week is the ban on local governments reducing their police budgets. That was something the Senate Republicans had approved and the House took out. But they created a lot of new felonies for things like rioting and being present during a riot, unlawful assembly. They raised from a simple misdemeanor to an aggravated misdemeanor, and also assaulting penalties for what they call, you know, assaulting civilian employees of police and fire agencies, and then things like blocking traffic or engaging in vandalism, those things, there would all be penalties. And what I thought was incredible was they actually eliminated liability for drivers of vehicles who injure someone who's part of a protest. So if somebody's blocking the road in a protest and you hit them with your car, you can't be held liable for that. I mean, that seems very worrying. So, and the other part of this Back the Blue bill was something that the Iowa Senate raised and the House approved that part of it. So it codifies this concept of qualified immunity, which means if a law enforcement person violates your rights, you can't sue them for violating your constitutional rights if it's related to their work as a law enforcement. And there would be very, very limited exceptions. So the Iowa Supreme Court had a ruling in 2018 that cleared a path for people to sue police for certain types of misconduct. And this bill scales that back. So they make it a standard that would be extremely difficult for a plaintiff to ever succeed in court if there were some police excessive use of force, for example, or if you were detained unlawfully when you hadn't done something wrong. That's going to be very difficult. But this bill, because the House changed it, it's going back to the Senate before it gets to the governor. But I do expect that the Senate probably will approve this Back the Blue bill.
You know, this, as in so many other things across the country right now, both sides, if you think there are just two sides, are talking right past each other. There was a protest, as you know, Laura, this past weekend in Des Moines, Black Lives Matter protesters demanding that the Des Moines city manager be fired, that the police chief be fired, that the city police department be defunded, in fact, that it be dismantled. None of that's going to happen. And yet now you have, that's one side, and then you have the legislature absolutely backing the police. I mean, I don't know where this ends, but I know that no one is close to the middle right now. There's no compromise.
No, and I mean, remember that Iowa still has felon disenfranchisement. I mean, we have, if you, once you complete your felony sentence, you can get your voting rights back. But I mean, this is pretty serious. If a lot of people who are present at a protest are charged with felony disorderly conduct, they could be losing their constitutional rights for a long period. And we don't know, you know, how prosecutors are going to approach these new crimes, defacing property. But, you know, I mean, is it, do we really want that to be a felony offense to deface property? I mean, I think that there, it hasn't really been thoroughly debated. It seems like this was thrown together in a rushed way. I should say that there was, it wasn't strictly a party line vote on this Back the Blue bill. There were a few Democrats who voted for it, mainly Democrats in marginal districts, very competitive districts. And there were two Republicans who voted against it.
This is not quite associated the same way as what we've been talking about, with what we've been talking about. But lawmakers also passed a bill last week to criminalize certain types of trespassing on agricultural facilities. It's the latest attempt to stop animal activists and others from secretly documenting activities at large animal feeding facilities. It's an ag gag rule, et cetera. The House passed it last Monday night. The Senate passed it last week. So this has been in the works for a while. Again, punishing would be, if you will, not protesters, but investigative reporters, journalists, for going in and documenting activities inside the animal bins.
Yes, whistleblowers. This is now their fourth attempt at an ag gag. So the first two have been held up by court. The third, there's a federal lawsuit pending. And this is the fourth. This one was scaled back a little bit. An earlier version of it was a little more expansive. So my understanding is that if somebody is employed by an animal production facility, and they raise these, they're recording, or they raise these issues, that they couldn't be prosecuted, but this would mainly apply to people who are trespassing. But still, I mean, a lot of people are concerned, and Senator Liz Mathis, she's a Democrat from Cedar Rapids, who used to be a television journalist for a number of years, and she was explaining how this could really affect reporting. I mean, you could be trying to expose pollution, but if you go on somebody's property and take a sample, either a soil sample or a sample from a stream that runs through their property, you could technically, you could be prosecuted under this law, and that could have a real chilling effect on news gatherings. So I do expect that this one, the governor is going to sign this. I mean, she always signs everything that the agriculture industry wants, but I expect that there may be another legal challenge to this bill as well.
Well, you brought up Governor Reynolds again, so let's segue into something that you wrote about, and you are a prolific writer. I'm going to give you props again for Bleeding Heartland, the blog site. You can Google it, and Laura's writing, if not nine times a day, at least nine times a week. I think you have to sleep at some point, Laura. But you wrote last week that Governor Reynolds had approved bonuses for at least five state agency directors, allowing them to get more compensation than the top pay scale that Iowa law sets for their jobs. Talk about that one.
Yeah, so this is something I've been working on since November, actually. I requested information about bonuses. There's no place on the state website where you can go and look and see who's getting a bonus. So you have to request records on payment records and employment records. And it took me I had requested this information in November. I didn't receive it until late January. And then they were slow to answer my follow-up questions. But what prompted me to write about that was actually Erin Jordan of the Cedar Rapids Gazette. She got hold of letters showing that Paul Trombino, who's the new Homeland Security and Emergency Management Agency director, that he got a very large bonus, about $46,000 annual bonus, which allowed him to not get a pay cut from when he moved from working on the governor's staff to this top agency position. And I didn't have that letter, but I did have information from my previous records request on these other four agency directors who have been receiving bonuses. One of them, Debbie Durham, now she's been the director of the Economic Development Agency for 10 years, and she's always been paid above the maximum salary allowed by law every year. So for the first 7 or 8 years, she was getting about an extra $30,000 a year. And the last few years, she's been getting an extra $50,000 bonus. And in the process of requesting these records, I learned that Kelly Garcia, she was hired to be the Department of Human Services director. And the governor said at that time that she had given her a one-time signing bonus of $50,000. That was in 2019, but I learned that last year that bonus was extended, that $50,000 bonus was extended for a second year. And I also learned that the Iowa Department of Natural Resources Director, Kayla Lyon, she was given a $25,000 bonus, and that was only in her second year on the job. So she was hired, relatively inexperienced when hired, and hired at the very top of the pay scale. And then after 1 year on the job, started receiving these bonuses. And the last person to be getting a bonus that hadn't been publicly mentioned is the director of the Department of Public Safety. And he also, after about a year and a half on the job, he started getting a bonus of about a $30,000 bonus. So in any case, it's really, I think that there needs to be more transparency because it's very hard to find out what these people are being paid. And perhaps if the state law sets a pay scale that is underpaying some of these agency directors, maybe the right way to go about this would be for the governor to ask the legislature to amend the law rather than giving bonuses to just a handful of agency directors.
Well, let me ask you to clarify, is what the governor did legal?
Yes. There's no issue with giving bonuses. I mean, you can question whether it's consistent with the spirit of the law, but the governor is able to give bonuses and pay directors above the top of the scale. As I mentioned, Debbie Durham has been receiving large bonuses since 2011. So this is not new, but it is new that some of these directors, it hadn't been noted before. And Paul Trombino, I mean, it was news that when he moved from the governor's office to this other position at Homeland Security, that normally that would have required a pay cut, but it didn't in this case because the governor offered him a bonus that was just large enough to keep his salary at the same level.
We have about 2.5 minutes left. You also wrote last week on Bleeding Heartland that about Governor Reynolds' campaign, which opted donors into recurring donations, kind of a tricky thing there. How did that work?
Well, it's for a long time, if you give online to a candidate, often the form will ask you to if you want to make this a recurring monthly gift. And so you have that option. But what I realized recently was that the Governor Reynolds campaign was doing something that the Trump campaign did last year. So if you click through and say you want to support with a donation, those boxes that make your gift recurring are already pre-checked, and also an additional gift. So a one-time gift on April 15th or another one-time gift on April 30th, those are pre-checked. And if you don't uncheck those boxes, you might not realize. And this was brought to light by the New York Times early this month. There was a huge story that the Trump campaign was using these recurring donations so often, in fact, toward the end of the 2020 election cycle, making them weekly instead of monthly. And there were a huge number of consumer fraud complaints, and the Trump campaign ended up refunding a lot of money, huge amounts of money to donors who had wanted to support the president once, but didn't realize that they were being opted into that. So anyway, the governor's campaign hasn't changed that. I just checked yesterday. And if you click through the online donation form, it'll still show you. You can uncheck the boxes if you notice that. You can uncheck them so that your gift only occurs once. But otherwise, if you sign up to give $10 today, it's going to, or $100 today, it's going to take out that same amount every month. And it's also going to take out the same amount on April 30th.
Okay. Well, let me ask you another question. One last question. What's the latest on the housing discrimination bill? I ask you that almost every week.
You know, yes. And I've been looking and it's still in limbo. I don't know what's going on with there. It's been more than 4 weeks now since the legislature gave final approval, and it doesn't seem to have been sent to the governor yet. So something is going on. There's probably some kind of legal analysis is going on with that bill. And I will be writing about that very soon.
And what do you expect on the legislative agenda this week?
Well, there's a bill that would shield the trucking industry from liability, certain types of lawsuits. And that was something strange happened last week where they tried to bring that to the floor of the House. Then they withdrew it. It seemed like they didn't have the votes. But I expect some attempt to get that on the agenda in the House. I also expect that the Senate is going to take up or that the House will take up the abortion constitutional amendment, which was the House passed earlier in the year, but then the Senate amended that and slightly changed the wording as we discussed last week. So I expect the House to take that up as well.
And we'll be watching it. Laura, thank you for joining us again.
Thank you.
Laura Bell and I, we're going to be right back here in this same time slot next week, we promise, with a look at what makes news with the governor and with the Iowa State Legislature and what it all means for all of us. Until then, thank you so much for the privilege of your time, and we hope you have a great week.